Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Just a quick disclaimer, this interview was recorded on the audio interface that I was previously using just for a week or two now, and since episode 499, almost every interview has been recorded on this new Rodecaster you hear. So if you're wondering why this episode sounds a little different, that's why, but it's still a great interview. So without further ado, enjoy.
My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, a podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most. Because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success.
I've been telling everybody that our government is shady. But every time I do, my family thinks I'm crazy. The hollow earth, UFOs, aliens invading. Pour it in the water, this way our skies daily. When I talk about these things, they think I'm crazy. There's no escaping anymore, the evil that we're facing. Illuminati mind control, they're sacrificing babies. The end of days, but anyways, my family thinks I'm crazy.
What, they don't want to listen to you? No, they don't want to listen. They don't want to hear it. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with
this is
your
Mark being Mark again.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know? If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You'll just tell your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
They think that I'm crazy. They really think that I'm crazy. They really think that I'm crazy. My family thinks that I'm crazy!
She was like in the other world. And at first she's so happy to be there. And she's talking about how joyful it was. And there's people dancing and having parties and everything. She meets her deceased son who's there. And she's just filled with joy about the whole thing. And then at some point, this deity spirit at a volcano that she visits, a sacred volcano in the other world, comes and says, actually, it's not your time to die. You have to go back. And she says, but I don't want to. I really want to stay here. And she's resisting being sent back. And at that point, the spirits in the other world who were friendly to her just a few minutes ago turn on her and they start chasing her back to her body. And even then she's like resisting and pleading. And she gets back to her body and she says, I saw this cold, dead thing lying there and I didn't want to get in it. Did I have to get into that horrible thing? And even then the spirits, like, they have to force her back into, and they describe pushing her soul back in through her big toe, which is a really interesting cultural element because I found it like in lots of Polynesian NDEs and afterlife myths, the soul going in through the big toe. And then the woman who recorded this account for her, it was published like in some popular magazine in the 19th century. She said she never ceased to regret coming back to her body for the rest of her life. So it's a really profound thing. So a lot of people who have NDEs, they're transformed and they're no longer afraid of death and they're able to live a more positive, less materialistic life afterwards.
You just heard today's guest, author Gregory Shushan, who joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this conversation with Gregory Shushan. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. And joining me today is a guest who has spent the course of 4 well-researched, well-written books diving into a topic that is near and dear to me And I'm very excited to have him on today to dive into his latest book. We have Dr. Gregory Shushan on the show, joining me for the first time. And your latest book is Near-Death Experiences in Ancient Civilizations, The Origins of the World's Afterlife Beliefs. So I have to ask, did you yourself have a near-death experience? Because it seems like this is a main interest for you.
Yeah. Well, first, thanks for having me on your show, Mark.
Of course.
Appreciate it.
Of course.
No, I haven't had one. And that's the kind of assumption a lot of people make, that my interest in it is so, has gone on for so many years and I've written all these books, but I haven't had one myself. But it's really, I guess it's a few things. It's not just the near-death experience that's interesting to me. It's the cross-cultural, ancient, and indigenous religious beliefs associated with near-death experience. So, because I came to it from Egyptian archaeology, strangely enough, rather than from like medical sciences or psychology, like people like Raymond Moody or Kenneth Ring or Bruce Grayson, a totally different kind of angle that they've been taking all these years.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a really interesting approach that I think is probably probing into the phenomena better than some of those folks from the world of health and medicine. So were you studying Egypt as an archaeologist, as a student? What got you into the study of ancient Egypt?
Actually, I traveled to Egypt and when I was about 20, I think, and I enjoyed, it was an amazing place to go. And I enjoyed experiencing the place just aesthetically without really knowing much about ancient civilization, other than it's ancient. Like, I didn't have, and I knew like Egyptians came before Greeks and whatever, but I didn't go having studied the civilization. So much of what I was seeing was just like, what's going on here? What is this? What does all this mean? What do these hieroglyphs say? And it was the same traveling around other parts of Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East. So I thought I need to go and actually formally study this stuff. So I decided to study Eastern Mediterranean archaeology and then Egyptian archaeology, which my first degree was at University College London at the Institute of Archaeology. And then I started getting these ideas as I was reading the ancient Egyptian afterlife texts, especially the pyramid texts and the coffin texts, which precede the Book of the Dead, the earliest descriptions of the afterlife journey from ancient Egypt. I just started thinking, if you strip back some of these cultural symbols from these texts and look at them as themes, as thematic descriptions of an afterlife journey, it sounds awfully familiar. So leaving the body, entering darkness, coming out into a realm of light, meeting a being of light, which in Egypt is the sun god, Re, meeting your deceased relatives, having an evaluation of your life's actions on earth, feelings of transcendence and oneness with the divine, and also even seeing the body from a perspective outside it. So a sort of out-of-body experience, which I think was symbolized in the text by the soul of the dead being associated with Osiris. And the soul meets Osiris in the sort of depths of the underworld, and it's described as his corpse, his decomposing corpse. And the text says, basically, you are one and the same as this god. And so therefore, that encounter with the corpse is the encounter of the soul with his own corpse. And in order to transcend that moment, they have to come to the realization of that they have basically survived the death of their own body. And that's exactly the thing in near-death experiences that makes people come to that realization, when they see the body and they realize that they've survived that physical life, and yet they're still conscious. So, I recognized all this and I thought, does this mean that ancient Egyptians were basing their afterlife journey beliefs on near-death experiences? And so I delved into that.
Yeah, well, and I'm wondering, with that in mind, what do you make of the Giza pyramids and the whole complex of structures there? So much of archaeology seems to point at these structures being funerary mainly, but nowadays we've got a lot of alternative researchers and a lot of pop internet theories that would make people think that this is something else entirely. But given your main interest, do you think that the pyramids functioned in that way? And if so, were the Egyptians building these structures to help aid someone in the afterlife? Was there any sort of potential of that happening?
Yeah, they are funerary architecture. From my perspective, there is archaeology and there's speculation. There's not alternative archaeology. Alternative archaeology, even Graham Hancock has basically said, I have no evidence. So it's maybe too dismissive to say he's just making things up because he's coming to conjecture based on a certain number of assumptions that he builds one on top of another. So, but in archaeology, from my perspective, I'm an evidence-based kind of person. So I don't really speculate beyond what the evidence suggests. But as to the question, yeah, absolutely. The pyramids functioned as, there's this, in Egyptian religious thought about the afterlife, there's this kind of dual mirroring going on where things on earth are mirrored in the other world in the insubstantial afterlife form. So the coffin texts, for example, they describe on the one hand, the sarcophagus being wheeled in the pyramid or into the tomb in the ritual sense. And it describes basically what's happening in that ritual, because the pyramid texts are ritual texts. But at the same time, it talks about things going on in the afterlife. So it's basically the funeral is facilitating the corpse journey in the other world. Just as in the same way that all of the grave goods are basically reproduced in the other world for the soul of the dead to be able to use them while there. So yeah, in that sense, it's almost architecture and text are mutually integrated into the pyramids.
Right. It almost seems like there was anxiety, obviously, about the afterlife. So to build something reliable in stone that you know is going to last is not only going to ensure that the pharaoh or this great king is not, he's going to go on to the afterlife, but then also be treated as a king there as well, right? This is the idea, is to maintain that dynasty into the afterlife.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Maintaining that, the kingship. And even the king is, everybody is associated with the sun god, but the king especially, it's this constant litany of the son of the sun. So, yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And also, it's worth pointing out that these monumental architecture, whether it's the pyramids or other the huge statues at Abu Simbel or the Colossae of Memnon or whatever, they are afterlife related, but they're also very much about establishing the power of the king within contemporary society at the time. So it's not just the function to facilitate the king's journey to the other world and keep his corpse safe, but very much to reinforce his power.
Right. Yeah. And they seem to be multi-purpose in nature. And the alternative researcher I was alluding to earlier is actually a guy named Jeffrey Drum, who has done a lot of really interesting work in Egypt testing. He comes from a chemistry background, and part of his theory is that some of these structures were used to create fertilizer that would have then been used in agriculture. So there are a lot of points of contention with Egyptology in particular. So it's hard to make heads or tails as someone like myself, an armchair researcher, especially when you have the hyper sensational stuff out there, as you put, a lot of conjecture, and I don't doubt that at all. But when it comes to the idea of near-death experience, it seems like there are a couple of misnomers that you're helping re-clarify or giving more context to around this subject. So one of the things that really stood out to me, maybe this can help bridge us into the rest of the conversation, is this distinction between the diffusionary theory and the universal theory, right? There's an idea that these things are cultural phenomena that diffuse from one to another in sort of telephonic action, whereas the other thought is that, no, this is universal to what the human experiences, and culture helps color that experience. Right. But each is different. And you give plenty of examples in the book, and you make a great case for showing that these near-death experiences are very different depending on what culture you're looking at. Of course, there's some universal aspects to it, like the fact that the body is dying and the soul is leaving. But yeah, as far as where we can draw that line of distinction, what to you proves one or the other?
I guess the way I would look at it would be more of how can we integrate those two different arguments rather than drawing a line between them, because I think it is both cultural and universal. Although universal, I hesitate to use that term because it's so universal. I would say quasi-universal or something. because there's always going to be exceptions because of just humans are diverse, our cultures are diverse. But yeah, so I would say, I guess I should clarify too that in Egypt, I didn't find any actual near-death experiences. So I was comparing beliefs and journeys to the afterlife in Egypt with ancient Sumer, China before Buddhism, India before Hinduism, and the Mesoamerican cultures of Aztec and Maya. So in all of those, unexpectedly, I found examples of near-death experiences, or at least texts that attested to knowledge of them, which I didn't expect. I just thought I was going to be comparing afterlife beliefs. But so, yeah, having said that, I found in the beliefs that there were those kind of particular nine elements that I mentioned earlier, leaving the body, the darkness, the relatives, the being of light, pretty much superimposed in the afterlife beliefs of every civilization that I looked at. And then within the near-death experiences in all the non-Egyptian societies, all of them had typical NDE elements overlaid with very obviously clear cultural elements as well. And they're always also, just to stress that they were contextually about the afterlife. They didn't have these experiences and think, oh, I went to some other place and it was very strange. They always said, this is an experience of life after death.
Right.
Right. Yeah, there wasn't a main consistency, but there are themes. There are themes that generally apply. But even down to the point of entering darkness, you said that certain indigenous cultures actually believed, and this isn't from your latest book, this is from one of your previous books, that they would follow a path rather than going into darkness. So it does vary based on the cultural and environmental circumstances of the person.
Yeah, exactly. So this almost archetypal near-death experience element of speeding through darkness with a light at the end of the tunnel, yeah, it's totally absent in some near-death experiences, especially in Polynesia, in some small-scale societies. They talk about walking along a path, and they will even say, I could see the footprints in the sand of the people who had walked there before me. And one particular woman says, as she's walking towards the spirit village, another spirit is walking back in the opposite direction. And that's somebody who has just had an NDE and they're on their way to return to their body. And so she's on her way to the spirit village before coming back. So yeah, which is interesting. But yeah, it's just the idea that the theme is the same. They're dying, they're leaving their body, they're traveling to the other world. It's just they're walking along a path instead of speeding through a tunnel. And that's important from the perspective of mainstream traditional near-death studies, from the scientific perspective, because there are all these theories that going through a tunnel is like the brain shutting down at the moment of death and consciousness kind of narrowing or restricting vision. And so if that's not happening cross-culturally, then that's a challenge to some of those materialist ideas.
Right, right. There certainly seems to be a push to homogenize this and give it all a clinical explanation. But yeah, as your book clearly lays out, yeah, there's a lot of variables here. And it seems like environment plays a role. And going back to the Egyptians, this is just my speculation, but desert is a very impermanent place. So to build these giant stone structures is, in a way, combating that inevitable shifting sands and the changing of the landscape that happens so rapidly in the desert.
Mm. Yeah, although in the ancient Maya Aztec world, they were also building these right. massive pyramids true, in the jungle.
True,
and
true.
In fact, I was just in Belize in Guatemala and was amazed. I was talking to an archaeologist there, and he said, look around at all these hills, and it's a very hilly landscape. And he said, there's an 80% chance that any of those hills are pyramids underneath. And then I spent about 4 hours exploring this site called Karakol. And I was thinking, wow, this is a massive site. And the archaeologist on site said, you've seen 1% of it. The other 99% has not been excavated yet. So these were just vast, massive civilizations, yeah, which is irrelevant, but it's interesting.
No, it is very interesting for sure. So let's get into some of the examples from the book, because a few that stood out to me were, and I don't want to skip ahead if you have some examples from the Sumeria, India, or Mesopotamia or India chapters, but the China chapter really stuck out to me. don't know, maybe I'm particularly drawn to Eastern mysticism lately. We've had a couple of conversations on the show in that vein. But there are a couple, one in particular, where a person ends up meeting somebody in real life that they had experienced in their near-death experience.
Yeah, that's a great example. I'm glad you brought that one up. This is from, I think, around 750 BCE. And it's a sort of local provincial governor, ruler type person, and his name's Qianzi. And the text describes how he falls prey to an illness and he's lying there on his deathbed and his soul leaves his body and he goes to the other world and he spends time with the emperor of heaven, as he describes him, some kind of deity or being of light. And he says he had a wonderful time and it was joyful and there was music and various other kind of positive elements to this experience. And it reads more or less like an NDE. It's not very long or detailed, but what is there is consistent with NDEs. But then he says that two bears appeared and attacked the emperor, and he shot the bears and saved the emperor's life, which is, I've never run across anything like that in an NDE. So obviously a very cultural element. And so the emperor thanks him and he says, gives him a gift, and he says, you're going to get positive things when you go back to Earth and your son will have good favor. And here are things, makes predictions about political events that are going to be happening, and he's going to send him back to his body. And so before he goes back to his body, Qianzi sees standing there at the emperor's side that there's a young boy. So he goes back to his body, and then fast forward a number of years later, it doesn't really say, but it's 10 or 20 years, and Qianzi is walking down the road in a completely different province in another town, and this man won't get out of his way. He's blocking the path, making eye contact, and Kenzie's looking at him and thinking, this guy looks familiar, but I don't know who he is, what's going on here. And so he says, do I know you from somewhere? And this man proceeds to recount Kenzie's entire near-death experience. And he says, on this particular day, you left your body, you went to see the Emperor of Heaven, you shot these two bears, the Emperor bestowed these favors upon you when you return. And he says, wow, that's amazing, how did you know? And this man says, I was the little boy standing at his side. And so then he just happened to recognize him in this village all those years later, which is it's pretty amazing, because that's a feature that happens in contemporary NDEs, this idea of meeting people in the other world that you didn't know had died. Whether it's a family member, you come back and you're told Uncle Bill just died, and you actually just saw Uncle Bill in the other world during your NDE, and then it's confirmed. Or sometimes children will meet people who they didn't know and they verify them from a photograph or whatever. This, not only the fact that these stories recur throughout history, but in this Chinese example, there was a very serious, it was taken very seriously, and there was an effort made to record this as faithfully as possible. They said, so-and-so was interviewed on this date, this other person confirmed it, this happened in this particular province. And this record was like filed in the Government Bureau of Records as an official document. And it actually proved to the ancient Chinese authorities and the priests that near-death experiences were valid and an integral part of their afterlife beliefs.
Yeah, that really stood out to me. And it seems to me like, and this could just be my own, the grass is greener type of bias, but it does seem to me like there are certain aspects of Chinese culture and other Asian cultures that are more rooted or grounded in spirituality. Maybe that's changed in the past 100 or so years, but I think the Industrial Revolution is to blame for that. But when it comes to China in particular, there's also an emphasis on the elements, and the one of the elements is space. As far as the heavens is concerned, it seems like certain cultures directly identify the path of the soul in the afterlife with bodies in the sky. Like in the section on India, you talk about how the moon is literally thought of as a gateway that you spend the whole entire phases of the moon. You spend those 4 weeks with the moon, and then you move on to the sun, right? Is this something that is reflected in other cultures too? Is this particular to India, maybe China as well? They're pretty close. There's a lot of interaction between the two cultures. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. In India, it's mostly I think it comes to kind of the fullest expression of that idea is in the Upanishads. It's not, as far as I can remember, I don't think it's in the Rig Veda, at least not as clearly and emphatically. But, you know, even in Egypt, there's this idea that souls of the dead become stars in the other world. In belief, the souls are identified with the circuit of Venus, just as in Egypt, they're associated with the circuit of the sun. So yeah, there's always celestial bodies involved. And also in Mesopotamia, Venus is a pretty important afterlife planetary body. So,
Yeah. And it seems like there's an astrological context to this. And I don't know that you necessarily make this connection, but when we talk about birth charts and the accuracy in a lot of cases of birth charts and the ability for birth charts to predict certain qualities in a person, wonder if the opposite is true, where your life dictates your next life in the other world, heaven, what have you. This is fundamental to a lot of religions, this idea of judgment. Is this something that is also major in a lot of afterlife methodology, or that's not the right term for it, concepts?
Yeah, astrology, not so much. I haven't really run across much overlap of astrology and these afterlife beliefs, unless they're embedded in the astronomical kind of descriptions, yeah, which maybe those people reading the text would have known, but they didn't tell us about them in the actual afterlife text. But yeah, as far as judgment goes, it's some kind of evaluation of your previous life is really common, almost universal in all these texts. It's not always necessarily a kind of external thing. Like in near-death experiences, it's often like you meet the being of light and that being helps facilitate the process of judgment, but it's really a self-judgment. It's like you're having your life review and processing for yourself everything that you've been through. And I think there's some hint of that in some of the ancient cultures, because it is usually a being of light that facilitates the process, but it's not a panoramic life review. It's not this like everything happening at once kind of thing. And it also depends on the culture as well, what is deemed to have been a good life and a favorable life. An even earlier NDE, actually, that's worth mentioning, is possibly the world's oldest, actually, was, everyone's probably heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh from ancient Mesopotamia. His Sumerian name was Bilgamesh, and he was actually a real historical Sumerian king. And there's this chapter called The Death of Bilgamesh, which didn't make the final cut in the epic. And it is basically, I think, an NDE. It describes how he's, again, lying there on his deathbed, and he leaves his body and goes to another world. And he meets the sun god of ancient Sumer, whose name is Utu, a being of light once again. And then there's a panel of judges, and they evaluate his life in terms of the Sumerian ideal of kingship. So in his case, it was like, did you maintain the temples correctly? Did you build new temples? Did you sacrifice to the gods? Did you do the correct offerings and funerary rituals? These kinds of things. But then also, did you provide for your people? Were you a just ruler? So it was a very culturally contextual thing, rather than were you a good father? It wasn't like personal family related things. It was more of a community thing. And so because of his judgment, he was found to have excelled at all these things. They decided to make him like half divine and a judge in the afterlife when he does die. And so then he has a funerary banquet thrown in his honor, and he meets deceased relatives and other people he had known in life. And then he's able to return to his body and prepare his tomb for when he really does die. So yeah, I think that's probably the world's first historical NDE account. That's about 1800 BCE. So more or less, so getting close to 4,000 years ago.
So, based on what we know about our beliefs about the afterlife, and now all the research coming out about NDEs, how has this shifted in your mind the way you see the world of spirituality, the way, you know, you see your own beliefs, really? How has this affected your outlook?
I'm constantly reassessing it, even though I try as much as I can to maintain like the academic scholarly central path and not let any personal beliefs impact what I'm doing. You can't help but to have it affect you on a personal level, because it is a thing that's going to happen to everybody. We're all going to die. But having said that, my conclusion is really that I don't know. And that I don't, and even more than that, I wasn't raised religious, so I actually don't understand what it's like to believe something. I feel like I either know things or I don't know things. And so I've had to get to the point where I'm comfortable in that this Christian mystical text always comes up, the phrase, the cloud of unknowing. And I feel like I dwell within this cloud of unknowing, and that we'll all find out when we get there. But maybe it's made me, I think it's probably made me less afraid of death. Not that I ever remember being particularly afraid of death anyway. But if I was, I think it's removed any of that fear. Somebody asked me the other day if I hope that there will be an afterlife. And I'm not even sure I can say that, actually. I think I'm at the point where it's, if there isn't one, I'll be cool with that. I'm just curious to find out whenever it happens, but I'm not in a hurry to get there either.
Right. Right. But at this point, it sounds like you're very confident based on everything you've looked into that it's an inevitability.
Yeah, I do think that there's going to be this extraordinary experience at death. And I think that it's totally reasonable to listen to what people who are clinically dead for a short period of time and then come back and talk about it. I think it's reasonable to listen to them, especially when they're saying similar things across cultures and for the last 4,000 years, at least. But at the same time, we don't really know what's beyond that particular point. I always just think it could be some cruel trick of fate. That even at that point, your consciousness survives your death for about 5 minutes, meets your deceased relatives, has this amazing experience, and then you die. We just don't really know what happens beyond that NDE point. They reach those borders and barriers. The being of light tells them to come back, and that's kind of all we know at that point.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors. Remember, if you want every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast ad-free and interruption-free, sign up on patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com. The links are in the episode description. You get every episode ad-free, interruption-free, plus bonus content, a show that I do every month, twice a month, with my friend and podcaster Juan Ayala. You do not want to miss it. It's a lot of fun. So go and sign up on patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com. And let's thank our sponsors. First and foremost, Above Phone, which has delivered you tablets, laptops, and phones completely decrypted and transparent, giving you the choice to go above. That's right. What are we getting above? We're getting above all this censorship, suppression, the tracking. You want real privacy with your devices? You are going to find solace in Above Phone. So go to abovephone.com/crazy and get a crazy discount on your Above Phone. That's abovephone.com/crazy. The link is in the episode description. And second, our next sponsor is Brain Supreme. I love Brain Supreme. It is a microdosing dream. This isn't some sketchy gray market nonsense. This is a holistic nootropic blend of supplements with the magic ingredient to help you blast off and recalibrate your cognitive abilities. I'm telling you, folks, Brain Supreme helps me lock in. And if you give Brain Supreme a try right now, be sure to use the promo code CRAZY and check out their free course. It will teach you everything you need to know about microdosing. Just go to brainsupreme.co and use that promo code CRAZY. All right, we'll be right back to this episode after this quick break. Remember, sign up on patreon.com/mftic or Substack to get the podcast ad-free, interruption-free, bonus content, all the good stuff, and early releases. This episode was out 3 weeks ago on the Patreon. What are you missing out on? What's there now? I can't tell you. Sign up and find out. We'll be right back. When life's song falters in the night and courage seems to drown, Hymns lifts your spirit anew, so desires can fully abound. For strength and passion to reign supreme when love's dance calls to play, Hims offers remedies that ignite your flame and help extend your stay. If dormant flames in passion's den leave your heart feeling withdrawn, Hims fuels the fire with ease and care, reviving where it's gone. When tailored cures to fan the spark, no doctor's door you need to seek. Reclaim your confidence and zest through Hims' discreet technique. For men who face such silent storms within the heart's domain, Hims ushers comfort quietly with solutions that remain. Wholly online, bespoke to you, removing burdens, lightening strain. Renew yourself with whispered ease. Let passion's song again be free. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/crazy. That's hims.com/crazy for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/crazy. The featured products include compounded products, which are not approved nor verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality by the FDA. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you about my favorite new sponsor. That's Mood. I love Mood because they're providing affordable, accessible, convenient, and transparent cannabis that's 100% legal and grown on small, pesticide-free American farms. That's right, American cannabis for American listeners. And it's 100% legal. They've got a full selection of cannabis products. I was a huge fan of their Tangy flower. Wow, it really brought me back to when I first tried Tangy, and it was incredible. So if you have any doubts, try Mood for yourself, and I doubt you'll be disappointed. Use the promo code CRAZY and get 20% off your first order at mood.com. That's 100% federally legal cannabis, pesticide-free, delivered directly to your front door in a discreet package. Mood.com, promo code CRAZY, and trust me, folks, you're going to love this stuff. I give it the Mystic Mark guarantee. And Mood is going to back that up because not only do they stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you get 20% off your first order with promo code CRAZY.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Yeah, it does seem like the academic consensus is that religion, spirituality, these are subjective phenomena that come from objective realities. And in a sense, someone can take your work and say, no, religion is objective because, look, these are objective experiences that are being had in a reliable way. We know that when someone dies, they're not just shut off. There is a consciousness entry point to something we just can't understand from this conscious place we're in now, right?
Yeah.
But I'm curious, what do you think of that? If somebody was particularly zealous about their religion, what would you say if they took your work and said, oh, well, this is proof that Christ was resurrected, or this is proof that X, Y, and Z?
they're welcome to do that. And I think there could be a pretty reasonable case to apply it in those kinds of ways. But at the same time, I would always point out, yet you don't have a monopoly on these experiences or on access to the divine. So I don't think near-death experiences and all my research really reinforces one particular religion over another. It also doesn't really suggest that we're all the same and everything's like this universal oneness or perennial philosophy of Aldous Huxley or whatever. I think it shows that there are similarities and there's diversity. And I guess the way I look at it is whether there's an afterlife or whether we're just talking about near-death experience, what it seems to me is there's objective experience types, but our culture and our way that our consciousness constructs symbols according to our cultural upbringing is projected onto those experiences and even enables them to be experienced, if that makes sense. They're almost contentless thematic ideas, and we project our reality onto them in order to be able to experience them. And I think that's a way of understanding and explaining both the similarities and the differences across cultures.
Yeah. Well, and I guess this is a place to ask you, how much influence does a culture have over somebody's near-death experience? I guess more sharp of a question would be like, can somebody who, let's say, has a similar background to you, secular background, if they're experiencing something, let's say, in a religious environment, can that color their experience, or they're more likely to have a, let's say, secular version of an NDE?
I think they're probably more likely to have a secular version and say, I saw a being of light, rather than saying, I saw Jesus.
Right.
But, you know, our culture is so permeated with religious symbols, mostly Christian. So even if an atheist does say, I saw Jesus, I'm not going to be totally convinced that it wasn't just a being of light who he saw as Jesus.
Right.
But, you know, it's almost like every element. I mentioned the tunnel and the life review are two that are not cross-cultural. But then you've got things like even returning to the body. So obviously returning to the body is a universal element of all NDEs, or we wouldn't have the account to begin with. But the reason for going back to the body is very much culturally determined. So for example, in contemporary Western accounts, the kind that we've been reading about since Life After Life and Raymond Moody, it's often, I was sent back to the body because I needed to care for my children, or I needed to, my wife needed me, or my parents needed me, or even things like I had unfinished work I needed to do. I wanted to finish my PhD or writing my novel. It's all kind of this personal stuff or family stuff. Whereas in other cultures, there's some examples from China and India. It's a case of mistaken identity. It was basically a clerical error in the afterlife. So if I were to die, they'd say, oh, we just noticed here, this is the wrong Gregory Shushan. We don't want the one in San Francisco. We want the one who lives in New York. So then I would return to my body, and then this poor person with my same name would then die permanently. So we've got the overall element of being sent back to the body, returning to the body, waking up. But the whole plot line surrounding all that seems to be culturally determined. And that's the kind of thing that I just don't know what to make of it. Are there really like spirit beings or deceased relatives in the other world who are giving us different reasons for coming back? Or is it our subconscious creating plots around our return?
Well, it reminds me of the whole concept of an egregore and this idea that these ideas have a life and a mind of their own. And maybe the more collective conscious energy that's put into one afterlife scenario, the brighter, the stronger, more potent that afterlife scenario gets, right? And to go back to the China examples, there's another story you gave about a governor who he dies, he leaves his body, and it's very quintessential of a guy who works in politics, in government. Like these men in uniforms come and throw him in a box, and then they bury him in the ground, and then like sometime later, he hears them saying something. They're like, oh, he's ready. Bring him back up. And it's, oh, bring him back up. Like, it's very Confucian. That was like the vibe I got from reading that. And I wonder how much of our collective consciousness and this egregore, whatever that truly means, plays into this. And to your point, what are these spirit beings actually living a life of their own and giving us a sort of subjective reason to come back? Or is this purely subconscious?
Yeah. It also makes me think of the theories that there was an Oxford philosopher named H.H. Price who had this idea of what he called an intersubjective afterlife. I talk about him a little bit in the book, I think. And this is basically the idea that the after, he didn't use the term lucid dream, but to me, it's essentially being described in terms of a lucid dream, but it's a shared lucid dream with the souls of other people. But because he acknowledged the cultural differences and even just differences between individuals, he kind of took it a step further and said, this would be group souls who are actually attracted to the same type of afterlife environment or whose psyches kind of work in similar ways. And then they would come together and kind of form these base realities. And then they could interact with other groups and cross over into other groups. And that kind of makes sense as well, as far as explaining the cross-cultural similarities and the particularities and everything else. Yeah.
That kind of reminds me of the monad, the concept of the monad, as I've learned it from a book called The Ascension Manual or something like that. Theosophical New Age type stuff. Nothing concrete, but they were describing the monad as this soul family that you're not necessarily actually familial with. There's no real blood relations there, but you come into carnation or incarnation as a family, as a grouping. Mm. And based on the various ebbs and flows of life, you may interact with these people throughout your life. They may be an enemy or a best friend, or you may never even see them until the afterlife, which plays right into what you're talking about there. And even this idea that might be, again, very speculative, but this Gnostic sort of idea. And I wonder if this has ever made its way into your research, that there are some religions or groups of people that believe that we're somehow trapped here in this prison type of not great, sort of gross material universe, and that the true purpose of being here is to wake up from that and go into our soul body and leave. That almost seems like an afterlife or near-death experience cult. Like they got so infatuated with the afterlife that they're like, all right, Earth stinks. Let's get out of here. Let's systemize this to get us out of here.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of NDE accounts, and actually it is a pretty major theme in afterlife beliefs across cultures that, you know, well, in reincarnation, like the goal is not to come back and do this again. The goal is to transcend samsara, the cycle of rebirth. But lots of people who have NDEs are not very happy about having to come back. There's a 19th century Hawaiian example that comes to mind. It's typical of a lot of NDEs, but it's emblematic to me because she was so emphatic about not wanting to come back. She was like in the other world. And at first she's so happy to be there. And she's talking about how joyful it was. And there's people dancing and having parties and everything. She meets her deceased son who's there. And she's just filled with joy about the whole thing. And then at some point, this deity spirit at a volcano that she visits, a sacred volcano in the other world, comes and says, actually, it's not your time to die. You have to go back. And she says, but I don't want to. I really want to stay here. And she's resisting being sent back. And at that point, the spirits in the other world who were friendly to her just a few minutes ago turn on her and they start chasing her back to her body. And even then she's like resisting and pleading. And she gets back to her body and she says, I saw this cold, dead thing lying there and I didn't want to get at it. Did I have to get into that horrible thing? And even then the spirits, like, they have to force her back into it. And they describe pushing her soul back in through her big toe, which is a really interesting cultural element because I found it like in lots of Polynesian NDEs and afterlife myths, the soul going in through the big toe. And then the woman who recorded this account for her, it was published like in some popular magazine in the 19th century. She said she never ceased to regret coming back to her body for the rest of her life. So it's a really profound thing. So a lot of people who have NDEs, they're transformed and they're no longer afraid of death and they're able to live a more positive, less materialistic life afterwards. But some of them also get pretty depressed that they have to be here.
Yeah, well, that's really apt that you'd say that, because I actually have an experience where I interviewed an author who had a near-death experience. I interviewed him twice. The first time I interviewed him, it was very interesting, very kind, positive. And there was a very severe turn in his writing and his material. And now it reflects this kind of dark Gnostic belief, this nihilistic Gnostic belief that, all right, we're trapped here on Earth. This is bad here. We got to get back to the afterlife. So I can see the truth in that for him, where he actually experienced the afterlife. But then at the same time, it doesn't seem like it's been a very positive thing as far as the course of his work. And I don't know him personally. I just read his books. And yeah, his books seem to have taken a more darker turn. I don't want to mention his name. We don't need to get into that. But yeah, it's interesting. Are there any other accounts that you've encountered where people will come back from a near-death experience with this sort of bitter attitude about it?
Not that I can really think of, not as extreme as an example of that. Yeah, it's usually a positive transformation, which they talk about lasting pretty much throughout their lives. So that's an interesting example that this person was positively transformed, but then after a while, he came to look at it from a different perspective. But it sounds like even if it's darker, as you said, it's still a spiritual perspective that he has.
True. Yeah, no, it could be the Earth that's getting him upset, not the spirit world. But yeah. Well, and that brings to mind another experience that I've personally had with not quite an NDE, but I wonder what your thoughts are on this, how you interpret this. So about 7 or so years ago, my grandfather passed away. And a couple weeks before he passed away, he told me about some dreams that he was having where he was interacting with people from his life that had passed away before him. So he was having these sort of preemptive near-death dreams and was trying to make sense of them, because he knew he was very old at that point, but he knew that these people he was seeing in his dreams had passed away already. So it was, hey, you're going to be joining us pretty soon. Right. And I'm curious how common that is and where that fits into this whole near-death experience. Because it's a little different than somebody hitting their head or having an accident, getting poisoned. We've heard about those near-death experiences. What about a pre-death, what would you call it? A natural death, right?
Deathbed visions, they're called.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Wow.
So how close was he to death when he was having these dreams?
It was a few weeks, but he died from a fall. So there was no, it wasn't like he was on his deathbed. He was still moving around and whatnot.
Okay.
But yeah, he was worsening. His condition was getting worse as far as his health. And then he had these dreams a couple weeks or around that month before he died.
So something was preparing him, whether his subconscious or something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess those would just be counted as dreams, possibly precognitive dreams. And I've come across those cross-culturally as well. But then there are the deathbed visions where somebody is actually on their deathbed and they see, rather than going to the other world and seeing their deceased relatives, then they see them, their presence in the room. That's pretty common if you just talk to hospice workers and people like that. It's incredibly common how much they talk about that. It happened with my dad, in fact. So he sat up and said, Mama, and looked up. Held up his arms. So yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is interesting to find how common these experiences are. And even near-death experiences happen quite often with cardiac arrests and people being in comas. What's the history of comas? Are they related to this topic at all? Because I imagine at some point in ancient past, people probably didn't distinguish very clearly between death and a coma. And maybe there were some subsequent accidents because of that, people getting buried too early.
Yeah, that's a good point, because all the near-death experiences from the past, well, and I would say 99% of them anyway, we don't really know how close the person was to death. All we know is whether that the people in that culture considered them to have temporarily died. And I'm sure they had their own ways of checking that, whether it's like a mirror under the breath, you know, to see if the breath is going to fog up the mirror, or being stuck with a pin or whatever it is. But yeah, there's no way to really tell whether they were really dead or not. So there were probably cases where somebody was just in a temporary coma and then woke up and had the appearance of death.
Yeah. And probably some really strange dreams during that time. Asleep. Wow. And this does relate in a way to sleep paralysis as well. There seems to be similar, if not maybe a little bit more sinister visions seen during sleep paralysis. Has this been maybe equated to near-death experience throughout history?
I don't think so. No, I think it's a pretty different phenomenon, but it's related in the sense of how sleep paralysis is explained. You probably know David Hufford's book, The Terror That Comes in the Night. He was the sleep paralysis guy. So he isolated it as a phenomena. And then he also found examples of it cross-culturally described in very similar ways. And he found that, so there's, just in case anybody doesn't know what it is, it's basically you're in this half awake, half dreaming state called the hypnagogic state. And you feel like you can't move, like you're immobilized. You can't scream or call for help. And you feel like there's a weight on your chest, somebody pressing you down. And there's this malevolent presence there in the room. So Hufford, in his research, found that those basic elements are the same across cultures, just like I did with NDEs. And he found that the identity of that being, of the malevolent figure in the room, is the thing that changes cross-culturally. So in Newfoundland, they say it's an old hag. And in China, they say it's an angry ghost. And somewhere else, it's an alien or whatever. And I think that was a really important piece of work because he actually came up with the term, the experiential source hypothesis. And that was that spontaneous, genuine experiences, whether they're veridical or not, happen to people. And then people create their beliefs in the supernatural and the spiritual based on those experiences. And what was particularly interesting is when I came up with my hypothesis about this, and when I was writing my first book and doing my early research, I hadn't come across David Hufford or any of the other people who had argued similarly. And that's because it's been this kind of like wavy undercurrent in the history of religions where one scholar will write about it for a sentence or two and they'll be in sociology and another will mention it in anthropology 50 years later and nobody connected the dots. And so Hufford was in sociology and I wasn't looking at parapsychological work or anything else. So I didn't run across his work until after I had done lots of my research. So I was able to then think, okay, this is validating stuff for this hypothesis. And then I thought it's worth bringing that whole idea together in this large research project on NDEs.
It's fascinating. I've never experienced sleep paralysis, but I have heard it's very common. More people than you'd think have experienced it and maybe just didn't know what was happening, chalked it up to a bad dream, and maybe haven't talked about it. But yeah, it's fascinating to think how these, what we now think of as in terms of medicine and health, how these experiences would have affected somebody's reality. And in terms of spirituality, in many ways, I don't think there is a distinction, you know, what our health, our spiritual bodies, our physical bodies, they're all connected. And something like a bad dream can actually have a negative effect on your health, or an idea can make its way into becoming a serious issue for somebody, like the whole voodoo concept or hypnotism. There's plenty of strange ways this can affect people. But in the more positive realm of things, there's the shamanic sort of initiation that's taken place through NDEs. And I wonder, I haven't read the book you wrote specifically on this topic, but where do rites of passage play a role into the experience of NDEs? Because it almost, I got the sense when I learned when I was younger about shamanism and these rites of passage, specifically the eagle claw, where they would string you by the muscles in your chest with an eagle claw and be in pain for a certain amount of time. It seems to me like they're trying to simulate a near-death experience or even provoke one in order to have a transformation take place.
Yeah, for sure. Actually, I just want to backtrack 1 minute before we look at that question. Just about sleep paralysis. Even if somebody doesn't look at it as a dream, even worse is if they think it's real. And then they proceed through the rest of their life thinking that they had this terrifying supernatural experience. And they might also think that they're crazy and they might be afraid to talk about it. So I just wanted to make the point that part of what's important about this kind of work, whether it's sleep paralysis or NDEs, is depathologizing it and making people feel like they can talk about it without being seen as crazy or stupid or vulnerable or gullible or whatever. So yeah, I just want to make that point. So yeah, but as for the shamanic interface with NDEs, it's really overt in a lot of the indigenous societies, most especially in Native Americans. They're basically religious movements such as the Ghost Dance, the Indian Shaker Church, and the Dreamer religion, which were actually founded on the near-death experiences of particular prophets. So they would have these NDEs and come back to life and then institute shamanic ritual programs, basically, to enable anybody to access the afterlife without having to actually die. So it was like democratizing shamanism and democratizing the afterlife. And they would do this by repetitive dancing and drumming and singing, chanting, drug use, to the point that they would collapse from exhaustion and with the idea in their minds that they were going to have an out-of-body experience and travel to the realm of the dead, to the spirit land. And so this happened. So it was really like a kind of, I call it the shamanic replication theory, because it's basically shamanic experiences are trying to access the same realm as NDEs. And the reason I think it's replication is because NDEs are spontaneous and they happen whether a person wants it to happen or not. So I think the knowledge about NDEs came first, and then the shamans were developing the ways to actually facilitate getting there in a safe way.
And this goes back to what we initially were talking about. And I know the mound building culture is not necessarily connected to the Native American tribes we know now, but there are structures throughout North and South America that Native Americans most likely, and in some cases have built, aligned to astronomical positions, and then also are positioned towards the equinoxial points, right? Or is it the solstice? I always mix those up. And this has something to do with the afterlife too, right? The journey of the sun. And as the sun sets, the equinox would be sort of like a fixture point for people to focus their attention.
Yeah. And it's the same in Mayan pyramids as well. They actually have astronomical observatories, and archaeologists know exactly what they are, and they know what the symbolism. And there were giant stone monuments that were placed in the field in front of the observatory to help them map the stars. So I don't think it's stretching the imagination or being woo at all to talk about mound building astronomy or in any other society. And we know it from ancient Sumer as well. So.
Yeah.
And well, yeah, I think there is definitely a connection with the afterlife, because with the Maya afterlife, I mentioned this connection with the circuit of Venus. And there was this notion that Venus was associated with the jaguar, and it's kind of transformational between the jaguar, a human baby, and the planet Venus as it went through its circuit in the sky. And I think those observatories were probably to chart that action of Venus.
Now, it sounds like the jaguar is playing a role, but is it playing a role in the same sense as a psychopomp, the way you described the dog being a psychopomp in certain Chinese depictions of the afterlife? And then I think in Native American culture as well, the dog takes on this significance.
Yeah, no, I think the jaguar probably has more of a shamanic relevance. There is a dog in, I don't think in Mayan, but there is an Aztec afterlife mythology. And it's a very kind of storytelling motif. It's something like only a dog that's white can pass. And if you go there with a brown dog, you have to wash it. It's some kind of thing that I think of to probably engage listeners with a storytelling feature, which was maybe even to make people laugh, to keep them engaged and to learn something about the spiritual intent of the text overall.
Right. Well, and I know that some mounds are effigy mounds and shaped to be certain animals. There's even man effigy mounds. But are there any particular animals that fit the role of the psychopomp better than others, or that appear in more cultures than others? It seems like birds might be a universal symbol of the psychopomp.
Yeah, I think probably dogs, or at least canines, okay, of some kind, canids. Because in Egypt, it was this Wekwawet, which was like a jackal, the opener of the way, he was called. And this, yeah, in China, I can't remember the particular reference, but there's definitely one in China and the Mesoamerican one. So yeah, I think it makes sense because dogs can be guides. They act as, there are guide dogs. And I think that's probably the case in other cultures in history as well. And they're also guardians. They protect you. So on your afterlife journey, it's useful to have this protector being with you. In fact, that's in India, in the Vedas, the dogs explicitly are guardians and guides. They have this dual role.
Yeah. Now, does the way the body is preserved or disposed of, I don't think that's quite the right term, does that play a role? Because I know in India, obviously, cremation is what you do, and it plays into the afterlife beliefs that you're actually in the fire of the cremation taken to the moon from that point, right?
Yeah.
I think the Vikings had something similar where they would send you off on a burning ship. And so the whole funeral process varies from culture to culture. But are there any anecdotes that show where maybe some of these practices relate to near-death experiences?
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't find like a direct correlation between burial rituals and burial practices. And in fact, corpse disposal is a term that anthropologists use, even though it's a pretty gross one. But so I didn't really find like a hard correlation between that and the way the journey to the other world is described. So like in Egypt, it was entombment, but they still described ascending to the other world. And in India, they described the soul ascending on the cremation smoke of the person's actual body. So yeah, so the body would be burning and that's how the soul would actually rise. And then was it India? I can't remember. Some culture had both burial and cremation, and they still nevertheless had ascent. And I think on the most kind of basic level, the whole idea of ascending has got to symbolize an out-of-body experience, because nobody who has an out-of-body experience says, I sunk through my body and into through the earth and into the solar system below the earth. That just doesn't happen. Everybody rises above. And probably not coincidentally, I don't know of any afterlife belief around the world that says I sunk through my body through the earth. So yeah, I think on a kind of wider level, a lot of these ideas that we almost take for granted might have origins in these kinds of experiences. And even the whole idea of gods, if beings of light are appearing to people in near-death experiences, to me, it makes perfect sense that would be the origin of belief in a god. Where else would people get that idea? There's no, obviously no proof of that. That's going into the realm of speculation. And I think probably totally overstating my argument, but it's still, I think, feasible.
Oh, and it would track this whole concept of the egregore and cultural ideas taking on a life of their own, that maybe they would be anthropomorphized. These various aspects of society would be anthropomorphized in this afterlife realm. Feel like I'm running the risk of sounding like I'm trying to explain it materially, but I think there's room for both this scientific and spiritual exploration of this and some mid-ground between the two, which is, I think, very much what your approach suggests. You seem to not be too rigid at all in the materialist, trying to explain things materially.
No, I'm not. In fact, I really try not to even go there as far as, does the evidence that I'm finding across cultures and throughout history suggest that there really is an afterlife? The kind of furthest I've gone in that direction is to say, for one thing, it challenges the Western stereotypes about NDEs, and it challenges some of those materialist explanations. For example, in the news media for the last couple of years has been the story that keeps being repeated about how scientists have discovered that there's a burst of electromagnetic activity in the brain at the moment of death. And they've said, okay, now that's responsible for the life review in the near-death experience, because all the boundaries in consciousness are shutting down, flooding the brain with memories just before it switches off. And so, yeah, it sounds reasonable and everything, but they're not looking cross-culturally at the fact that panoramic life reviews like that don't exist. It really is pretty much a Western phenomenon. There is that evaluation of your earthly life, but it's not in that panoramic brain barrier down, everything happening to you at once. Right. So I think it can be, some of these things can be a challenge. And also the one about the tunnel. If scientists are saying, Susan Blackmore, for example, saying that the tunnel is a result of the brain shutting down and literal tunnel vision. She needs to explain why tunnels are not being described in near-death experiences in non-Western societies. So I think there's too much overgeneralizing and too much theorizing going on based solely on a Western stereotype, basically.
Well, and to be fair, the Western civilization, the world that we live in, seems so modern and devoid of spirituality, but it's lurking. It might have some layers above it, but it's lurking. I spend a lot of time looking into the history where I'm from here in New England, specifically Connecticut, and I spent time looking into New Haven and the whole Yale University's complex. And it's a very interesting study of geomancy because New Haven is America's first planned city. And it seems like they use maybe some occult ideas in order to plan how the streets were laid out. And when I was researching this, one of the concepts or ideas I came across was this idea that the crossroads or the road between the church and the funeral had this significance, or funeral cemetery or burial ground. The road between those two places had a spiritual significance where people would see their loved ones who had just passed away in ghostly spirit form moving from the church to the cemetery sometime after their funeral had taken place. So these areas grew this reputation for magic, and then pretty soon people, what cunning folk they're called in England, would go to these places and utilize that energy for maybe a necromantic ritual or something like that, right? And it got me looking into my own area, and I found out that in a way, New Haven, as they were building the city and as the city changed and grew, this sort of thing happened where the cemetery and the churches got further and further away from each other until now there's this kind of infamous or notorious area between those two locations where Skull and Bones and the university law school and all these other, you know, again, this ventures into the conspiratorial, but it has this occult dimension to it that I think is so interesting because it shows how not only the culture informs the space, but then the space in turn informs the culture. Mm-hmm. I think that's in a lot of ways what we're talking about with the NDEs, where that space is the afterlife and there's this sort of interplay. It's not all one way or one side. It's not just the humans who are making the afterlife based on their culture. It's a little bit of both. It seems like there's a metaphysical reality there that we're actually interacting with, and it's not just this hallucination that the materialists want us to sort of be set happy with and settle with that. So I implore people to read your book and dive further into this subject because it really opens up the doors of perception beyond the material world and helps show how we as human beings are spiritually rooted. And again, no one religion owns that. I think that's another really beautiful point you made in our conversation. So I really appreciate you joining me, Gregory, and I'll give you a chance to comment on what I just said, but also please tell the audience where they can go to follow up with you and your work and also what you'll be working on next.
Sure. And I appreciate you having me on. Thanks. Thanks again. I'm pretty easy to find. Website under my full name is gregoryshushan.com. I have a Patreon page, which is also full name, and I'm pretty much all the social media. And books are available on, pretty much anywhere. So anywhere you buy books.
Wonderful. Well, it's been a pleasure getting to know you. And I am very excited to read the book that came before this one. And as a sort of perk, a benefit of signing up for your Patreon, you send a copy of, depending on what tier you sign up for, you send a copy of one of your books to your supporters, which is really awesome. So I would encourage my audience to take you up on that as soon as possible, because I'm sure supplies are limited, or maybe you'll get to the point where you have so many Patreon people that you can't send them all books, which we hope that happens for you,
because
that'll be a sign of success. So Yeah, I encourage people to go and check out your Patreon because there's a lot there and you also get a really great deal signing up. I've never seen any author do that, so I just wanted to highlight that because I thought that's really good to do that for your audience and send the book out.
Thanks.
As a perk for signing up for Patreon. So anyways, thank you so much for joining me again, and until next time.
Great.
For everyone listening, thank you for tuning in and immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. Ladies and gentlemen, that was our brief conversation with Gregory Shushan. And I had high hopes of recording for longer, but it just didn't work out. So I'm going to be putting out 3 episodes next week, just like I put 3 episodes out last week. And hopefully that'll make up for a shorter episode. But the goal is to do 2-hour episodes. It just doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes the guest doesn't have 2 hours to devote to the podcast. So we're going to make it work. But I say support Gregory Shushan. He's got a great deal on his Patreon for $10 a month. You get a copy, a physical copy of his book. His most, not the most recent one that we talked about, but his previous book. So, but he's got a whole list of options there, different tiers, and some of them include receiving a physical copy of the book. So check out his Patreon. I rarely recommend the guest's Patreon, but he is an author with a Patreon, which is cool. You don't see that very often. So go and support Gregory if you liked what you heard. And with that, folks, I'll see you on the Patreon, where we have some really great bonus content, a new episode I just did with Juan, so much more. We'll see you over there. Until next time, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.